Good morning and welcome to the 2014 KBOO Bike Show. Today on the Bike Show, we'll be listening back to some of our most memorable interviews of 2013, including Randy Cohen, former New York Times ethicist, Jonathan Mouse of Bike Portland, our coverage of the Sandy Ridge Trail System and the Little Ants Who Builds It, and Pete Jordan, more famously known as Dishwasher Pete, and author of In the City of Bikes, The Story of the Amsterdam Cyclists. We've picked only the best for our beloved listeners, so sit back, sip on your New Year's mimosa, and enjoy. In January, Steph Routh interviewed Jonathan Mouse, creator and head editor of the online news source Bike Portland. Jonathan took some time to sit down with us and talk about how his website has helped foster, create, and even change how we look at bikes move around us, and how the worldview has evolved as bicycling has gained traction. In this conversation, Jonathan explains why we may not want to use the word cyclist as a way to identify ourselves or others.
It actually does have a really big impact to start talking about the person and the way they got around as sort of a secondary thing. And many times the way people get around is not even really important to the story. That's another level of sensitivity and consciousness about this, is we've all assumed that it's important that we know how they were getting around, but that could be some vestige of sort of this, you know, discriminatory sort of outlook we all have around this stuff. A lot of times it's just people moving around the city and they have these conflicts, you know. So I'd like to kind of peel back all that stuff and say, you know, to what extent can we get rid of some of the controversy by just talking about people moving around the city and not the fact that, oh, they're a bicyclist or they're a motorist. And, you know, it's also a personal thing in the sense that I don't identify as any of that stuff. You know, I have a minivan. I drive it around sometimes. I just drove to California and back for the holidays on the freeway, all over the place. But I'll also ride my bike a lot. I mean, so how would I fit into that? You know, if I got hurt or if I was in the news and I wasn't, you know, Bike Portland guy, would they just call me bicyclist? And would that really sum up who I am or what I am or what I believe? You know, so it's I like to look beyond that.
In my other hat, as you know, I'm executive director of Now Oregon Walks, which was the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. One of the reasons was, you know, no one identifies as pedestrian because it's synonymous. It's become synonymous with banal, you know, or humdrum, and that everyone walks. It's like breathing. It's like, as Michael Colvin Anderson says, you know, it's like a vacuum cleaner. You know, where I think, as you've said, we want bicycling to go. It's a vacuum cleaner. It's a broom. It's, you know, one of those tools that you use in your everyday life. I do want to come to, I think this comes to the conversation about polarization that you've said, you know, let's get rid of this bike community idea. I just wonder if that statement is somewhere part and parcel with that desire to get away from polarization.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a part of that. I mean, anything people can conveniently pigeonhole and stereotype, I think we should work to rewind and unwind, you know. And that's certainly the bike community. You hear that from local media or anybody. It's like the bike community. You can hear it from a hater saying the bike community does this or that, or they need to do this or that better. As if we're all, you know, standing in one room and there's someone up on stage telling us what to do, and we're also part of some club or union or something. Like, it's just not, there's no basis of that in reality. But obviously there is a community. I mean, so instead of the bike community, I'll say more, you know, there's a community of people that care about this issue and that issue. Why put bike in there? Why does the bike have to be a big part of that? You know, or there's a community of people that ride bicycles, or a lot of people in our community care about issues, including bicycling, blah, blah, blah. So it's just a different way of framing it.
One question I do have, because I'm executive director of an organization that is based on a movement of people who don't identify as, you know, people don't identify as walking. And so activism has been, it's been more difficult to identify, to rally behind and to develop momentum for. So I just wonder, is, to what extent do we want to dismantle bike community if that activism of that identity and that movement is helping bicycling become more possible for more people?
Well, first, I would argue that we have to be willing to consider that it's not helping that identity. That identity is not helping. That identity of bike community feels good for people that identify like that, but that's it. it doesn't feel good to everybody outside those who identify like that, right? So I think that's important. We could have a conversation about, is it working? Is it helping? Mm-hmm. How many people are biking? How many could be biking? A lot of people aren't because they don't see themselves as bicyclists because they're not a member of the bike community.
And yet people who do see themselves as the bike community do testify in Salem. So,
people that care about these issues testify in Salem. They're caring about whatever issue or ever value that is related to the fact that they ride a bicycle. They're only testifying as a member of the bike community by the people that call them a member of the bike community, or they themselves identify themselves like that, and that's up to them to identify themselves any way they'd like. But we're having more of a sort of a philosophical conversation about what might be the best way to go about it, or what are the merits of always focusing on this identity. And advocates are guilty of it too, because that identity equals excitement. You identify as something, you want to pay into it, you want to donate to it, you want to become a member of it, and that's how advocacy groups survive. So they have a real interest in making sure that identity stays there to some degree. It's important to, I think about the fact that, I use the word selfish a lot in terms of the bike community. It's similar how I feel like sort of, ghost bikes and the ride of silence, right? For people that identify as bicyclists and identify as members of the bike community, it's thing that really feels good to them to memorialize and talk about that kind of stuff. But to people outside of that, you know, is that really achieving a good thing to be focusing on the fact that someone died doing this activity, right? It feels good for the people that are in the movement, but what is the signal it's sending outside the movement? And I'm always just trying to check that relationship. Is what we're doing in the movement, let's say, it may feel good to us, but is it achieving our goals? Is it really doing the stuff we need to do, which is sort of break down these walls and these silos of being in a movement and making it so that the entire community believes in these values and wants to be a part of this movement.
We were lucky this fall to have Randy Cohen, former author of the New York Times Ethicist column, join Michelle and I to discuss ethics and the bicycle. Randy Cohen turned out to be one of the liveliest guests of the year, referring to himself numerous times during our interview as, quote, not a nice person. In this segment, we learn why Randy is a cowboy at heart and how he sees the same evolution Jonathan Mauss described, forcing new rules for how bicycles behave on the road, and why he detests seemingly polite drivers.
Randy, I want to ask a question from one of our Facebook followers that relates to what you were just talking about. You were talking about how the damage that you can do if you bicycle drunk or impaired is to other people is so much smaller than the damage you can do if you drive impaired. Although, of course, the damage you can do to yourself may be similar. One of our listeners, readers, our Facebook followers asked Leslie Carlson, she asked, should we be citing people on bikes at stop signs the same way we cite cars? Can we treat bikes and cars differently even though they share the same road? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yes. I mean, the answer is an unambiguous yes. I've written about this, I am one of the New York cyclists who routinely runs red lights, and it was a moral defense of that. The traffic rules that are often applied to cyclists now are, for the most part, rules written for cars, but a bicycle is not a car, nor is it a pedestrian. We have things in common with both, but we are neither. We are a third mode of transportation, and reasonable traffic rules, which we should obey, must regard us as such. So that here is my guideline for red lights, and I would apply it to stop signs too, that when I come to an intersection, if I do not have the right of way, I have the red light or I have a stop sign, I will run through it if and only if there is no one else in the intersection, no pedestrian in the intersection who I might endanger, and no car in the intersection who might endanger me. Under those conditions, I will run red lights, and I believe it is an ethical thing to do.
And when you are walking
And you get to the corner. Do you have take the same approach?
Yeah, I take exactly the same approach. And that's what's interesting in Manhattan, at least. Everyone takes the same approach. Mm-hmm. And by everyone, I mean everyone. There is no New Yorker who will stop at a red light if there are no cars coming, nor should you. If you're standing on some windswept, rainy road in the middle of the night and there is no traffic as far as you can see, and you have the red light and you stop, well, I don't think you're a law-abiding citizen. I think you're an idiot.
So my question to you, you said if you're not going to endanger anyone, what if there's cars or pedestrians in the intersection that you wouldn't endanger but are just there? Will you still?
I sometimes proceed very, very cautiously, but I think the pedestrian cross, the pedestrian with the right of way, if I have the light, I go.
Right.
I have a red light or I have a stop sign, and there's a pedestrian. It's not simply that I shouldn't physically harm them; that I shouldn't encroach in their sense of being safe and being treated courteously. So I'm not supposed to come within 2 inches of them. But if they're well past me, I might slow down and continue. Yes, I confess it. But again, it doesn't set the bar high enough to say simply, I have not actually killed anyone today. Mm-hmm. You really should treat your fellow citizens with courtesy. They should enjoy being outside and walking around. They should not feel in constant danger.
Well, in that same situation, this is Tori, in that same situation, I find myself kind of in the Canadian response. If there's anyone, my rule is if there's anyone in the intersection at all, even another car waiting for the same red light, I won't go because I want to set a good example.
Yeah, I will go because I think I am setting a good example. Just as when I'm on foot and I have a red light, but there's no traffic in the intersection, I will cross the street. I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. I think that's an example of honorable civic virtue.
And Randy,
and I feel the same way on my bike, even though I have a red light. And I believe the car must err on the side of obedience because the car can do horrible, horrible damage. I mean, cars in America kill about 30,000 people a year, and they send about 10 times that many to the hospital. That's serious stuff. And with that comes serious moral duties. That is not true of pedestrians, and it is much, much, much less true of bicyclists. And so your conduct must be shaped by how you're likely to affect other people. And so just as I am more like, in that circumstance, I slow down for the intersection, but I'm not going to wait there to set an example for some motorist. Why should I do that? Why is that good? Why are you not setting a bad example of blind obedience and bringing on a fascist takeover of the United States that will lead to just the kind of breakdown of society that your friend, the disaster person, was, you know, so optimistic about? How well we'll all behave.
So, Randy, I'm picturing the person in the car at the deserted intersection, and Tori rolls up on her bike, and she stops, and she looks at the person in the car, and she thinks, I'm not going to go because they'll see me, and it will make them mad, and they'll think, oh, those law-breaking bicyclists. And then you walk up on the corner, and you look around, and it's clear, and so you walk across the street. I think that for the person in the car, you walking across the street is much less likely to tick them off than Tori riding through that red light. And I have wondered about this because we all get around by different modes. There is not a group of people who are pedestrians and a group of people who are bicyclists and a group of people who are motorists. And yet, well, for a lot of people, when they're driving, they think of pedestrians as more like a shared group. Like, they, you know, nobody says those darn pedestrians, they're always jaywalking, but people will say those darn bicyclists, they're always running red lights.
Yes, I think your observations are completely correct, but I think your conclusions are not something I can share. That it's absolutely true that people are angry when they see bikes running red lights. It does not necessarily follow that they're correct to be angry, or that they're demanding something reasonable of me, or that I should shape my conduct to fit their irrational response. Mm-hmm. I hope that in the fullness of time and with the improvements of infrastructure, that people simply become accustomed to seeing bikes on the street, and they will just as people in New York anyway don't expect a pedestrian to stop when they are not going to endanger anyone else or inconvenience anyone else, they'll get used to seeing that same behavior with bikes. It's part of it is just the novelty of it, and part of it is making a false analogy between a bicycle and a car. A bicycle is not a car and ought not be governed by the rules that govern cars.
Mm-hmm.
But
and,
again, nor are we pedestrians. We're a third thing, and in some parts of New York's bike infrastructure and in fantastic places like Amsterdam and Copenhagen, you know, where there are bike lanes with their own traffic lights and their own very cycle-oriented traffic rules. And people tend to follow them in part because they are reasonable.
Mm-hmm. And what you're describing, a bike is not a car. It's a separate thing. It's a separate beast. It's as unlike a car, really, as a person walking is unlike a bike. I think that is a source of some of the outrage that we see, that we hear about when people who mostly drive see people who are bicycling break a rule, is they have an expectation that that bike is supposed to behave just like a car, even though it's fundamentally different.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. And part of it is because, you know, you guys keep stopping at red lights and reinforcing that sense that a
I'm a red light runner.
I'm doing, you know, some social good. I'm risking my safety for you.
Well, and I'm going to push back in that
figure here.
A big part of that is coming from the fact that cyclists are using a shared road, which people have seen as a place where these rules are and are enforced for a long time. And that's one of the big differences between pedestrians and cyclists, is pedestrians are crossing the road, cyclists are in the road with the car, and that's where that mentality, I think, comes from of, well, you wanted to be here in this road and not on the sidewalk and be treated like a car, so now we expect you to behave like
a car. In fact, that was the mantra of as a former professional bike advocate, I will say. When I came on the scene, that era was sort of sunsetting of, we have a right to the road, our rights, bicyclist rights. This is wonderfully spoofed in a Portlandia episode, bicycle rights. And that's really not what bike advocates are trying for anymore. It's not about a group of people who were denied rights to the road anymore. It's about giving more people the opportunity to cycle. But I could see that this is the unfortunate side effect of decades, perhaps necessary decades, of pushing for rights to the road, in which then it was accepted that the bikes would obey the same rules of the road.
And I'm not disagreeing with you, Randy, that I am being old school in that mentality and not forward thinking in that maybe I was indoctrinated in that same mentality. And so that's my wanting to be courteous, or what I see as courteous, at the stop sign and stoplight and say, well, I earned my place here, so now I want to show that I can be respectful and keep it somehow.
It lacks drama, but I agree with you both. Nor am I critical of the policy decisions of cycling advocates of the past. I completely agree that it was a very clever strategy. It was an effective strategy. That the first step was to assert a right to be on the road and express it as a right. And the exchange was, and you can govern us the way you govern all who use the road. But political thinking changes and evolves, mm-hmm. and circumstances change, and we have to adjust our strategies to fit them. So it's not to deprecate the past in any way. I revere those cycling advocates, but different times call for different approaches.
Mm-hmm. I have a question that comes up kind of all the time for me recently, as we use the road more, and it kind of falls into this being treated as a pedestrian or being treated that weird wonky line that we ride. When vehicles stop from you and they have the right of way, I refuse to go because I don't have the right of way, because when they stop and they don't have the right of way, they're usually blocking or confusing the traffic behind them and potentially creating a dangerous situation for me to cross the road in front of them, because nobody else may realize why they're stopping or they don't have the stop. So I feel like it's putting me in more danger. And it's actually, I think statistically in Oregon, it's one of our biggest insurance problems, of a huge number of accidents are actually caused by people, quote unquote, being nice, being courteous. So what's your take on that, and how do you handle those situations?
I've encountered it too, and I totally agree that it is foolish conduct generated by amiable motives, but utterly benign motives, but it's really misguided. And I hope it's clear, I'm a much less nice person than either of you. I resent it for another reason. I refuse to go because for some driver to somehow allow me to go asserts his right to make that decision. It's not up to him to decide whether I go or not. He does not own the road. I'm not using the road out of his generosity. I frequently behave very rudely to such drivers, and they're really affronted. They think they're being nice. It's someone treating my being on the road as a gift they have to give me.
Great for drinking. And by which I think you meant that you can bike to your drinking destination and then drink and then take a taxi home.
Well, taxi, you and your family.
Subway.
Ways.
Subway.
Oh, you take the subway home.
Or a bus. Hey.
A bus.
Take a bus.
You like the bus? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I mean.
But I, I've been a bike professional for many years, and I so often field questions from people, or really their complaints, they're disguised as questions. people who... And generally not people who bike a lot themselves, although they probably do bike because this is Portland and basically everybody rides a bike sometimes. And they say, I really hate it when those bicyclists do X, they're going to get themselves killed. And they're generally describing something that people do in their cars. And it might not be legal or it might not be approved, but it certainly not doesn't elicit outrage. So one example is listening to music on headphones. Now, we all drive in our cars with the windows rolled up, nice, you know, soundproof cars, muffling all the outside noise, windows rolled up, and the stereo blasting, and nobody says, I hate it when those drivers don't have all their windows rolled down in the winter so they can hear what's around them. And then there are a couple of other things, and I think, why is our standard so much higher for riding a bicycle than for driving a car, that we have to be like so on alert when we're bicycling? It's our responsibility to be so supremely alert and defensive that we're held to a higher standard than when we're driving our car. Why do you think that
right.
is?
I agree that I recognize the phenomena you're talking about. I agree that it's unfair. And I'll offer, I guess, two explanations, and neither of which is meant to justify this. It's completely unfair. I agree. One is that we're in a period of change. And people tend to just accept the status quo. And so the way in which the private car dominates urban life with incredibly socially destructive implications, people are just used to that and take it for granted. They take it for granted how cars get to park in the street, cars get to pollute the air, you know, we should spend an enormous amount of public money to maintain this road system. They're just used to it. The increase in bicycling in New York City, at least, is quite rapid and quite extreme, and so people notice the change and fear all change. I think that's part of it. The other reason, I think, is that when we're on our bikes, we're akin to pedestrians in that we are right out there on the street where people can make eye contact with us, people can talk at us, they sometimes curse at us. And so people are more can be more aware of what we're doing.
Mm.
Also, we're vulnerable, that we are less likely to harm someone else. If you scream at someone in their car, they can run into you, or they're encased in this steel fortress. We're right out there on the street in a more egalitarian way with the people who are criticizing us. So we become a target for some frustrations.
So to put a finer point on it, do you think it's more okay to bike while after drinking than to drive after drinking?
Neither is okay, but both are different in this way, that again, as a matter of personal safety, neither is wise. And it's probably worse. Drunken cycling is probably worse.
For one's person.
For the person on the bike, yes, for oneself. That's not a moral problem. That's just a matter of personal safety. It becomes a moral problem when you affect other people. As a moral problem, drunken driving is infinitely worse. You will do serious harm to others. You're very unlikely to do really serious harm to anyone on your bike. I think drivers kill about 100 non-drivers in New York every year with their cars. Bicyclists, I don't think we've killed someone in, I think it's 5 years. We're falling way behind. We'll never catch up. So you just, you know, 2,000 pounds of steel, you can do a lot more damage. So drunken driving is more of an ethical problem than drunken cycling. I used to see this difference when I had the ethics column. I had very few questions about this sort of thing. But if you look at I used to read the bike blog in The Guardian, which I thought was a wonderful thing. They were constantly getting questions about drunken cycling. I think a higher percentage of Londoners bike to work and they drink a lot more than we do. You know, one other thing we haven't mentioned that I wonder if you guys notice is, and this is entirely anecdotal, I don't have any data to back this up, but my impression in New York is a great deal of the conduct that non-cyclists get very, very angry about is engaged in by a tiny minority of cyclists, and it's commercial cyclists, it's delivery guys especially.
Mm-hmm.
That's who I notice, or it seems to me that's who I notice, going the wrong way up runway streets, which makes people very upset, going through red lights just as I do. But I do. It's interesting that often a fairly small percentage of a population can be disruptive, and but in a way, it's hopeful because it's quite manageable. That these are we should remember, these are really hardworking guys. They're overwhelmingly immigrants. They're horribly paid, and that we shouldn't be vindictive in treating them. But that they can be held to a higher standard, especially through their employers, by penalizing the employers, not the individual cyclists. And New York is addressing that. They're aware of that a small group of people actually may be creating this bad blood, and there are solutions that are not harsh to reforming their behavior, and I'm hopeful about that.
Well, and I, interestingly enough, I had an experience this morning that kind of shocked me in Portland. I was riding down a bike boulevard, which is one of our side streets that are very active, and there's one that crosses a major intersection. But only bikes can cross the road at this point. And the bikes have the stop. The road that you'd be crossing always has the right of way. And two older, looked like conservative dress, going to business work, not young, not messenger, decided to not yield the right of way when there was a giant Water Bureau sewer truck coming at them. And no, it wasn't very smart, but it was the kind of high risk behavior that I tend to see in people who do that kind of work for a living and are on the road a lot more. And I thought to myself, are we getting to a point as we do find ourselves more and more on the road and have more rules and rights to be there, that it's becoming more somehow ethically okay to demand space that isn't yours?
My experience is a bit opposite, but it's also very tentative. That it seems as bicycling becomes more mainstream, and when we're given safe infrastructure and we're integrated into the larger transit community, people behave more prudently and conservatively. And I'm thinking of Amsterdam and Copenhagen again. Where people don't wear helmets and because they don't need to and because the ride is quite safe, they tend to be more law-abiding. It's like, you know, we used to be cowboys and now we're settlers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law has come to Dodge, and I know it's good. I know it's better. The law book is better than the six gun, but, you know, I've grown up on a lot of cowboy movies, and it's hard not to be, you know, a sentimental idiot now and then.
You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show, KBOO FM 90.7 on your dial. Today, it's the new year, and we're revisiting some of our best stories from 2013.
On my bicycle, up the slope and down the hill, with the hair in the wind, it's such a thrill. On my bicycle, like the world has ended, but I'm not sorry. On my bicycle. Everything gets returned back to Mother Nature, better sooner rather than later. You could say
Bike Show welcomes you to a brand new 2014. Happy New Year! If you were ever a fan of zines in the 90s, Dishwasher Pete will be a familiar name. Lucky for us, he grew up, moved to Amsterdam, and fell so in love with the city and its bicycles that he decided to be the first to document the full history of how two wheels shaped the entire city and its inhabitants. Steph Routh was lucky to find Pete Jordan stateside for a few days this spring, and he shared with her a bit about his new book and how Amsterdam changed his life and shaped his family.
I moved to Amsterdam in 2002. I went there for a four-month study urban planning, and I wanted to learn how the Dutch designed their cities for cyclists, because I heard Amsterdam was a cycling capital. I didn't know much more about the Dutch or Amsterdam than that. I knew they had something to do with cycling, so I went there, and I fell in love with the city within days and decided to live the rest of my life there. So far, it's been 11 years. I'm still there.
What caused the love affair? What do you
mean? Well, a big part of it was the cycling. I was already an ardent cyclist for years in America, but that meant being very much a marginalized road user, always pushed literally to the margins, and it was frustrating. And I didn't realize how stressed I was on a bike. I always thought I was more relaxed on a bike, and people in cars were the ones who were stressed. But after I got on a bike in Amsterdam, I realized, oh, now I'm really relaxed, because I didn't have to worry about car doors, for example, every 20 feet, and... I just felt respected. I felt a human.
This book, In the City of Bikes, had such an incredible amount of research that you've done. How long did it take you to research, and how did you come by all the research that you were able to access?
How long? Too long is the short answer. But it was, 4 years or so, maybe even longer. The idea was that the book would be about 70% personal and 30% historical. That's what I envisioned it. But as I started doing the research and became more and more fascinated and covering more and more things that Dutch people themselves didn't know about their own history, eventually the book became more about 70% historical and 30% my own personal history. So I basically just kept digging and digging and digging in every archive I could find, the city's archives and the war documents archives and the national archives and all the university libraries. Some of it was very methodical, sometimes just going through the newspapers page by page for different dates that I was interested in. And some of it was more random, just standing in the stacks at the university library and picking up books that I thought were interesting. And I was actually just at Powell's this morning and found myself in the Dutch section and pulling out books that I hadn't seen before. And book from 1919 from an American in Amsterdam saying that the Dutch treat cars with contempt, which I found interesting. But I have lots of those kinds of quotations in my book, but it's interesting that I never saw that one before. But just a lot of digging, and sometimes I just had a vague idea of what I wanted, but once I started, I realized, oh, there's something here to it, and I would continue researching it. But also I always wanted to sort of have personal flavor, a characteristic of Amsterdam, and I could always just write, oh, this such and such happened, but I really wanted things to be said in people's own words, eyewitnesses' words. Mm-hmm. So there were times when I spent a couple of days going through records or going through newspapers searching for a quotation that I could use that would best tell the story in someone else's words and not my own words. Cycling in Amsterdam really exploded in the 1920s and 1930s. They were quickly became the kings and queens of the streets. They far, far outnumbered the number of cars in Amsterdam. Motorists were always very frustrated because, motorists wanted to go faster than they could, but with 30 bicyclists in front of them, behind them, around them, on either side, they had to go at the cyclist pace. So the Amsterdamers were already emboldened by being in their huge numbers, cycling together in their huge numbers. But when the Nazis invaded in 1920 and quickly won the war between Holland and Germany in 5 days, they immediately felt, okay, we're the victors, we're the occupiers here, we're the bosses, so of course you're going to obey us. But it only took about 3 or 4 days before the German officials were complaining to the Dutch officials, hey, these cyclists on your streets, they should be yielding to us. We're in our big military vehicles, and yet they act like we're invisible. And they're riding slowly in front of us. They're cutting in front of us. They're running red lights. So Dutch officials, you need to crack down on this. And the Dutch officials did what they could. They started fining the cyclists for running red lights and other infractions. They impounded bikes. They rode with vehicles with large loudspeakers atop them that mm-hmm. admonished the cyclists for the infractions that they were incurring. But they also would remove the bike valves from misbehaving cyclists. And Dutch bike valves, unlike the American bike valves, you could take them apart. And once they're apart, then obviously the air escapes from the inner tube. And if you don't have valves, you're screwed. So, they would take the valves from the bikes, and cyclists were left to walk their bikes to a bike shop to buy new valves. Or I guess if they wanted to, they could still just ride on their tires, and flattened tires. But the Nazis eventually rescinded that order to remove bike valves because the number of bike tires was limited in the country. There was no more rubber coming in from the Dutch East Indies. So the tires that were wearing down were irreplaceable. So they realized, taking the valves from the tires was actually hindering the populace because they needed those tires as much as possible because they didn't have cars. The Nazis began stealing the bikes from the Dutch, which is... Everyone knows that story in Holland because they still talk about it. And the Dutch still demand from German tourists, or especially at football soccer matches between Holland and Germany, the Dutch like to sing, "Give us back our bicycles."
Mm-hmm. How do you say that in Dutch?
Eerst mijn fiets terug. The bicycle during the wartime became the greatest symbol for the Dutch, for the atrocities that the mm-hmm. Nazis did to the Dutch. Obviously, they slaughtered more than 100,000 Dutch Jews and slaughtered many political prisoners and stole anything and everything they could. Stole all the trains, stole all the trams, stole so many cars and trucks and artwork, anything you could think of. And yet, it was the bicycles that the Dutch were most touchy about and remain so.
Do you ever get pushback from people? It's like, you're American, what do you know?
Before the book was published, yes, because the only time I could, when this ever came up, was when we were speaking about it, and my Dutch is broken enough and accented enough where it discredits whatever I'm saying. Every Dutch person feels that they of course know more about Dutch history than I do. So it's hard, but now that the book is written and that's so well documented and telling them so many things that they don't already know, I've been getting a lot of praise for it, mm-hmm. which I've been very, very poor.
And the book is also, you were saying, in Dutch as well as in English?
Yes, it was translated into Dutch.
After chronicling the Nazi occupation and its impacts on cycling and city life, Pete Jordan describes a few critical moments for cycling in Amsterdam. One of these moments occurred on October 3rd, 1960, when the bustling street of Leidsestraat was closed to cyclists.
That's a major street in Amsterdam. We say major, and although it's where we're sitting, probably every street around us is wider than Leidsestraat. But because of its location between the city center and some of the residential districts, it was a major cycling street where tens of thousands of cyclists during the rush hour each way would force their way into. But there's also trams and cars and pedestrians and the push carts. So for a long time, the question of how to get all these people through the street safely was an issue. And there are a lot of ideas were floated through the years of how best to resolve the issue. And eventually in 1960, the city father said, well, let's just ban cyclists from the street, which was great for the car drivers, even though cyclists outnumbered car drivers, 10-1 at the time. Yet the city fathers had no interest in cycling. The mayor at the time said, in 20 years, no one's going to be riding a bicycle in Amsterdam. Everybody was focused on the car. The car was going to be the future.
The Ant Farm, a nonprofit in Sandy, Oregon, helped to build one of the Northwest's most sought-after and award-winning mountain bike trails. They did such a great job that the trail is considered the gold standard across the United States for mountain bike trails. I was lucky enough to have Sam Hardy, the foreman of the Ant Farm's trail building crew, and one of his crew members on to share what it was like to be a part of creating such a special place. Ant Farm does so much more than just trail building, but are also stewards of community community building through volunteering. In this conversation, their passion, integrity, and inspiration shine through.
As a perk. The mentality was, let's all get into a car, let's all enjoy cars. And the rich, of course, in the business class, they all wanted cars because that was a status symbol for them and something they could easily afford. The social democrats and the socialists and the communists, they all wanted cars too, because why should only the rich have cars? It should be the working man also should have a car. Cars were becoming far cheaper and wages were going up and scooters were now exploding in Amsterdam, and there was nothing done for cyclists. There was no bike racks, there was no bike lanes. Bikes ruled the streets just because of their great numbers, but as there became more and more cars, cyclists became marginalized. I felt like this period in around 1960 exemplified that. As the 60s wore on, it only got worse. And then in 1965, there became the first inkling of a cyclist pushback, that cyclists were now starting to stand up for their own rights. And that's when the anarchistic group, the Provos, suggested, hey, as a way to resolve these issues with traffic in the inner city, how about we have free bikes everywhere that anyone can use? And of course, the city fathers didn't listen to them, even when they formally proposed it to the city council. The idea spread worldwide within months, through the media. Hey, these people in Amsterdam, they want free bikes everywhere for the populace to use. It sparked something. It sparked the idea bicycles can be part of the solution instead of everybody having a right to a car. I mean, the Amsterdam politician who in 1965 was saying every Amsterdamer has a right to a car, by 1973 was it saying, okay, I think it's good if people start cycling again, because everybody having a car simply doesn't work. It helped spark the idea that that cyclists cycling in cities was something that needed to occur, that the cities needed to do something to encourage it. By the 1978, more of a pro-bicycle city government was elected. But even that took still a few years, till the beginning of the 1980s, before things on the streets began to change. And then for the last 30 years, an enormous amount has changed.
You have a son, Ferris?
Mm-hmm.
He's how old now?
He's 7 years old.
Okay. And you've been back to Portland and back to San Francisco a number of times, but he's grown up in Amsterdam. Obviously, our transportation systems are different. Mm-hmm. So, what kinds of questions does he ask when he comes back to America, and how do you explain the differences to him?
Well, it's interesting you'd ask that question, because, 2 days ago when we stepped off the airplane in San Francisco and got on BART and went to my family's house in San Francisco, we stepped off BART, walked upstairs to the street, and a muni bus came along, and on the front of the muni bus there was a bicycle on a rack. And he turned to me and said, What's going on here? I don't understand. Why is there a bicycle on the bus? Yeah.
Really? Why?
And I told him, well, here in San Francisco and other cities, Portland, there are racks on the buses, so a cyclist can cycle to the bus stop, put the bike on the bus, get on the bus, board the bus themselves, and then ride to their destination, get off the bus, remove the bike from the bus, and then cycle on the rest of the way. And he just looked at me like I was crazy, like, why would anybody do that? If they're riding their bike, why don't they just ride their bike the whole way? And I said, well, it's hillier here, and not every part of the city is bicycle friendly, and sometimes if you ride from one end of the city to the other and you just want to take the bus back, and he simply didn't get it. And yes, we don't have that in Amsterdam. And he asked why not, and I said, well, can you imagine if you did put a rack on a bus? I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of cyclists, and two spaces for bikes. I mean, it'd be chaos if people became dependent on that sort of system there, and the buses would take forever with all the loading and unloading of bikes.
What are some other things that causes Ferris to scratch his head, that you're like, I don't actually know why we do that. That's actually crazy.
Seeing so many adults with helmets on bikes here, it's something he's brought up. He wears a helmet usually in Amsterdam.
Is that a requirement?
No, not at all. There's only, I'd say, maybe 10% of kids there wear a helmet. And among those who do wear helmets, you've got children, and again, maybe 10%. You've got couriers, which I'd say even Portland has more couriers than Amsterdam, bike couriers. Oh. you've got tourists, but even then, just a minority of the tourists. And then you've got the racers who are on their racing bikes heading to the countryside to go really fast. But aside from those four groups, I estimate for my own sitting around calculating, counting cyclists, that maybe one out of 10,000 everyday Amsterdam commuter wears a helmet. So it's extremely rare for fares to see. We've been sitting here, and I'd say probably about 75% of the cyclists that have gone past here have been wearing their helmets. I was also cyclist spotting yesterday in San Francisco, standing at 16th and Valencia, and also a great deal of the cyclists there have helmets, an increasingly far greater proportion now than when I left San Francisco in 2002. A great many of them all had their maybe upwards of 2 inches of space between their chin and their chin strap, and they wear their helmets so loose, their straps so loose, it seems pointless.
It's like that would probably just strangle you if you went over.
Yeah, but I noticed Portlanders, they wear their straps properly. So I don't know if it's sort of a hip thing that where you wear your straps so loose there.
Just dangling.
Sort of like the style with wearing your shoelaces loose or something. I don't know.
For our listeners who don't know anything about the ant farm and its might of one and power of many, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the ant farm does and then how it got involved with Shandy
Ridge? Sure, sure. We do a lot at Ant Farm, and we're kind of a small nonprofit, but we've got a staggering amount of programs, it seems, at times. So to make it simple, we try and divide those things into indoor and outdoor classrooms. Primarily, we're a community center dedicated to serving the youth and connecting them with the outdoors and hopefully with job opportunities. Our indoor classrooms right now, we have an Access Learning Center where we offer free tutoring to the community. We've got a cultural art space, which is an art gallery, open mic zone. A local woman even teaches a yoga class there. And coming June 1st, we're opening up the cafe and bakery. So on your way to the Sandy Ridge Trail system, please check that out. Stop in for a smoothie.
That's pretty amazing.
And we're excited about
how about your workforce as it relates to the Sandy Ridge Trail system?
Our youth corps has taken off thanks to huge support from the Bureau of Land Management and Sandy Ridge. Our executive director lives just down the road from Sandy Ridge.
We've yet again come to the end of another KBOO bike show.
Driving up the road.
We're broadcast from Portland, Oregon on the first Wednesday of every month at 11 a.m.
So we sent a couple
podcasts are available on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com.
Can you tell me a little bit?
The bike show is produced by Michelle Poirot, Stephanie Routh, and myself.
Led by our
Tori Borgman.
Director himself.
We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer and our web host, Chris Smith, and our editor, Josh Hatcher. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the cycling world. Until then, have a great new year and keep riding your bike.
A real sense of accomplishment and gratification from the users for the first time in their lives. So that was a pretty big accomplishment in and of itself, getting these kids who society would otherwise deem incapable to really show them up and step up to the plate and get some real good work done.
That's pretty amazing. So as part of that, how many youth have actually worked on the project at this point?
At this point, in the past 2 years, we've had 67 youth. And really, we'll do whatever we can to get kids out into the woods. I mean, primarily, that's the goal, getting them out there and experiencing this project.
And part of your mission is also to not just connect kids with nature, but also to connect them with elders, which I thought was also pretty important. Yeah. And you can talk more about that, but I love the idea that it's not just a connection with nature and the land, but a connection with your community and where you come from.
I'd say that's a huge, huge part of our mission is fostering and heightening a sense of greater community in the Sandy area and pretty much everywhere anyone who's connected with the program goes. Our flagship program at Ant Farm is called Community Connect, and every Saturday, any kid who wants a job or anyone who wants to be involved has to show up and volunteer. We've got a huge binder filled with elders and disabled people who can't do things around the house for themselves, whether that's clean gutters, chop wood, mow the lawn. So we send our kids out and we serve. We do service projects. We do it for free. We bring the love.
That's pretty amazing. And you can feel that love in the trail system. Travis Roundy, who's one of the youngins. You're not that young, are you, Travis?
No, I'm 20 years old.
Yeah, I was going to say. How long ago did you get involved with the Ant Farm Workforce Program, though?
Well, I believe it was about 2 years ago I started volunteering with Ant Farm. Originally, I was just kind of going in and doing whatever they needed me to do as they got the facility up and running. I did a lot of work in the garden that they have that they'll be supplying all of the produce for the cafe with.
So one of the most amazing things that I really want to point out to my listeners about the Ant Farm is that it's community. It's a holistic look at the community. That Sandy Ridge is part of this, yep, because it's part of the recreational opportunities, but it's really helping out your entire community and seeing the community as a whole, which is why they're starting this restaurant and why they are burning calories for the restaurant out trail building. Travis.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I got involved in that. And then throughout my time volunteering there, I had some friends that were on the trail crew. And they told me that I should really check it out. And I got to know Sam and joined on at the end of it. So here I am continuing to go on.
So, Sam, do you have any idea of how many, Sam Hardy, do you have any idea of how many hours the Ant Farm has put in on the Sandy Ridge Trail system?
A lot. Quite a bit.
You, honestly, I'm a mountain bike rider. This right. is part of the reason I was inspired to share this story with our listeners. And almost every time I've been out, probably one out of three times that I've been out there, the Ant Farm is also out there. The Ant Farm van is out there. And it's so amazing to have that experience interacting with the people who are making that fun that Jill was describing in the trails being designed, to be able to just look at somebody and say, thank you.
That is a two-way street, Tori. I think a huge draw to the job, what makes it so amazing is that every day these kids get thanked. They get to feel the gratitude for what they're doing. They see people smiling. They hear people yelling, you know, flying through the woods. And then those same people stop, shake hands, give them a Clif Bar. They really feel the appreciation. And that's huge. As far as man hours out there, if you figure you've got 8 kids out there for 40 hours a week over 3 months, I mean, we're talking about quite a bit of sweat, blood, and smiles put into this thing.
That's no tears.
No tears.
Travis, speaking of no tears, is there any particular stories? Are there any moments that you have out there that really stand out for you?
There was a few times. It was towards the end of the season there. There was this one corner that we were working on, and it was just this gigantic rock formation. And we basically spent half an hour with rock bars and sledgehammers just slamming away at it consistently. Just go in and go in and go in, and eventually broke through. And seeing what we opened up and what we created to get, like, to create that corner, and how hard the work was to move that rock back, but knowing that we could do it with just our hands and a few tools, was a really gratifying moment for me. And knowing that that's going to be a really crazy feature for somebody to ride next season, you know, that feels really good, and that's a cool thing to walk away from.
It's really an honor to be a part of this team, Tori. I got to tell you, the culture of accomplishment that the Bureau of Land Management, International Mountain Biking Association, Northwest Trail Alliance, and everyone who's involved with this project brings to the table really, I mean, I fell in love with the project. I did anything I could.
Oh, Sam, thank you.
Summers running to get out there, and then I found this magical place called the Ant Farm. So, I mean, it's just a big win-win for me.
And Tom Slovak, do you at the Northwest Trail Alliance get to work with the Ant Farm?
So we do get to work with the Ant Farm a little bit. Primarily, they work during the week when they're working on the trail building itself. But they've been helping out and joining the Bureau of Land Management and Northwest Trail Alliance and the International Mountain Bicycling Association for the trail work days that we hold on the weekends. And it's been a great pleasure to work with Sam and Travis on those projects. Basically, Northwest Trail Alliance sponsors work days during the off season, and everyone has a really great time. And it's just been amazing. What you see at Sandy Ridge is a combination of both Ant Farm and also all the volunteer labor that's been put in at these individual work maintenance days.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And we got, it looks like some live music happening for the jazz program coming up at noon. First the news, and then you'll have jazz radio. Okay, thanks for tuning in to KBOO. Happy New Year, everybody. KBOO.FM. It's KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for January 1st, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson. In local news, a number of Oregon schools are eligible to apply for significant federal grants. The grants are focused on enabling chronically low-performing schools to spur dramatic changes and drastically improve performance. Six Portland-area elementary schools will be the first in line for consideration based solely on poor scores in 2011, 2012, and 2013. Earlier awards were given to Roosevelt High, Madison High, and King School. Washington State will receive a performance bonus of $7.8 million from the federal government in recognition of the number of children signed up for health insurance. This is the fifth year Washington has received this bonus. 20,000 children were signed up for free insurance between October 1st and mid-December. In national news, along with other disheartening information coming out of Washington, is the news that Congress will let a significant number of tax deductions for millions of individuals and businesses expire at the end of the year. Congress has been doing this for a number of years, making it difficult for taxpayers and businesses to plan for the future. Eventually, they reinstate the deductions and backdate them, supposedly writing everything again. Perhaps the practice best serves congressional interests by bringing lobbyists back to Washington every year to wine and dine Congress people to support their favorite legislation. It also creates another opportunity for politicians to seek contributions. This is just one more symptom of a highly dysfunctional Congress that poorly serves the American public. Hewlett-Packard is planning to eliminate 5,000 more jobs than previously announced because of a continuing difficult business environment. This brings the projected total to 35,000 by the end of the fiscal year. The cuts are part of an overall strategy for shifting away from PCs to mobile devices. Consumer confidence turned up sharply in December. At 78.1%, it is now close to pre-government shutdown levels. Consumers are more upbeat about the current job market and their prospects for the future. A federal court ruled Monday that the federal government can search and copy computers, cell phones, and other electronic devices at U.S. borders without reasonable suspicion. The ACLU attorney who argued the case expressed frustration at the ruling that portrayed the practice as a violation of the Fourth Amendment. An appeal is a possibility. Government records indicate that thousands of innocent American citizens are searched as they return from trips abroad. In international news, on Tuesday, a court in Bangladesh issued arrest warrants for the garment factory owners of the buildings that burned in 2012, causing 112 worker deaths. This is the first time factory owners have been prosecuted, which is surprising given how lucrative this industry is for the country. Another factory collapsed in April 2012, killing 1,100 workers and exposing the harsh and unsafe working conditions often found in these plants. Initially, when the fire broke out, employees were told it was part of a fire drill. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrives in the Middle East Thursday to present new proposals for peace between Israel and Palestine. Both sides are expected